Welcome to the 22nd episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Angelica Welch. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. On December 4th, we traveled to Texas for the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. At the meeting, physicians from all around the world presented studies in the field, several of which have had an immediate impact on practice. During our time there, we spoke to several principal investigators who detailed new applications of novel therapies, cervical intervention strategies, and lifestyle modifications. Beginning the week in San Antonio, we sat down with Charles E. Geyer, Jr., MD, who is a professor of medicine at the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine and the associate director for clinical research at the Massey Cancer Center. At the symposium, Geyer presented on the results of the Phase 3 CATHERINE study, which showed a 50% reduction in the risk of invasive disease recurrence or death with adjuvant T-DM1 compared with trastuzumab for patients with HER2-positive early breast cancer. For those who have residual invasive disease following neoadjuvant therapy, this is likely to become a new standard of care. Hear from Geyer himself on the rationale, design, and findings of the trial.
CATHERINE was a global Phase 3 study conducted by investigators committed to the neoadjuvant therapy of HER2-positive breast cancer as the optimal way to treat their patients, but also as a way to identify higher risk patients who don't benefit as well as we'd like. And so CATHERINE was basically a study to determine if T-DM1 might help the subset of patients who do not achieve PCR, who are at higher risk for recurrence, determine if they would benefit from T-DM1 rather than continuing their HER2-targeted therapy to complete a year. T-DM1 seemed to be an obvious choice because we know the drug has been approved and is active for patients with metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer who have had prior exposure to taxanes as well as HER2-targeted therapy. And we were wanting to find a drug that would probably work in early breast cancer patients who had been exposed to taxane and HER2-targeted therapy and had less than an optimal response. So it seemed a very straightforward idea to bring this into the early setting. And actually, we thought it was the optimal group in the early setting. The design was straightforward. We did not enter patients at the point that they started their neoadjuvant therapy. We knew we were doing a global study, that there would be lots of different regimens and things. So the study was designed to recruit patients who had received neoadjuvant therapy that consisted of certain minimum standards. They had to have 6 cycles total of chemotherapy. They had at least have 9 weeks of a taxane and 9 weeks of a trastuzumab. So we felt like that covered the waterfront for standard regimens. So they had to receive that. They had to have all their chemotherapy before they entered the protocol. And then they had to have residual invasive breast cancer. And we really allowed any amount of invasive cancer. For practical reasons, we thought to try to disallow people with RCB1 and these sort of things just would have been practically difficult. And we wanted to make certain that those groups would not benefit. So we had a pretty broad net for our eligibility criteria that did put some heterogeneity into the study, but as it turns out, I think that's one of the strengths of the study.
Next, we sat down with Andrea DeSensi, MD, Director of the Medical Oncology Unit at the National Hospital Oncologica Medicea in Genoa, Italy. DeSensi discussed the results of the Phase 3 TAM-01 trial, which investigated the use of low-dose tamoxifen in women with breast intraepithelial neoplasia. Although tamoxifen has been a mainstay in the treatment course for these women, compliance rates are notably low. However, the study showed that a lower dose of adjuvant tamoxifen not only reduced the risk of new and recurrent disease, but also the incidence of toxicity compared with placebo.
So tamoxifen is a very old drug. When it was developed in the late 60s, there was not much attention to its minimal effective dose, but we know these drugs bind to the estrogen receptor and has a saturation kinetics. So our hypothesis was that giving too much higher doses could not increase effectiveness but increase side effects. So we did in the number of, in the last 20 years, a bunch of biomarker trials showing that you can lower the dose, retain the benefits, and reducing the side effects. We then started to give low-dose tamoxifen, namely 10 milligrams every other day, to the women with DCIS. This was not a clinical trial, it was a cohort study, and the women who accepted to take low-dose tamoxifen had a much lower recurrence rate than the women who did not accept low-dose tamoxifen. So we then started a phase 3 definitive randomized trial. We included 500 women with either DCIS or LCIS or atypical ductal hyperplasia. And they were randomized to tamoxifen 5 milligrams per day for 3 years or placebo. And after a median of 5 years, we show that there is a 52% reduction in the risk of recurrence in the low-dose tamoxifen arm compared with the placebo arm. The study is not very big in terms of number of events, so we need to have more follow-up. The women are in follow-up to increase the statistical power, but this difference is already statistically significant.
We then spoke with Laura Spring, MD, a medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center and an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School. In the largest meta-analysis performed to date, Spring and her colleagues looked at the prognostic significance of achieving a pathological complete response following neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The study showed that achieving a PCR following neoadjuvant chemotherapy had a significant association with decreased recurrence and improved overall survival. Although the study is unlikely to manifest in a sharp rise in neoadjuvant chemotherapy, it adds to a growing body of knowledge on its utility in breast cancer.
We performed the largest meta-analysis to date looking at the prognostic significance of achievement of a pathologic complete response following the receipt of neoadjuvant or preoperative chemotherapy. So we focused on studies that both reported path CR rates that also reported long-term outcomes based on whether someone had a PCR versus if they had a residual disease. So our inclusion criteria included any study that looked at neoadjuvant chemotherapy and reported both PCR rates and long-term outcomes. So the studies had to have at least 25 patients or more. They had to use one of two specified definitions of path CR, so we use the stricter definitions that are endorsed by the FDA. We also excluded any studies that use different types of therapies before, such as radiation or endocrine therapy. So basically any study that used chemotherapy. These could have been patients who also received anti-HER2 therapies as well. So all breast cancer subtypes were involved. So overall, similar to prior studies, we found that the achievement of a path CR following preoperative chemotherapy is significantly associated with decreased recurrence and improved overall survival.
Providing insight into the management of hot flashes was Roberto Leon Fair, MD, an oncologist at Mayo Clinic. Leon Fair spoke to the randomized trial evaluating the effectiveness of oxybutynin chloride in managing the severity and frequency of hot flashes in patients with breast cancer, a commonly but poorly managed side effect.
Unfortunately, hot flashes and vasomotor symptoms in general, including night sweats and temperature intolerance, continue to be a major issue amongst breast cancer survivors, and not only in breast cancer survivors, but also in women in general as they transition through menopause. And with the cancer therapies that we frequently put patients through, including chemotherapy and anti-estrogen therapy, we can unfortunately see that breast cancer survivors experience either more severe or longer duration hot flashes than the general population, either because of chemotherapy-induced early menopause or because of the use of anti-estrogen therapies or therapeutic oophorectomy or use of medications that suppress the ovarian function. So vasomotor symptoms continue to be a major issue, and they don't only affect quality of life for our survivors, but also can affect compliance with this treatment. Many women may elect to interrupt adjuvant therapy earlier than anticipated or than planned due to the severity of the symptoms. So over the past two decades, a lot of research has been done on in using different medications to try to treat hot flashes and address this problem. Arguably, the most effective treatment is hormone replacement. Unfortunately, this is not really an option for breast cancer patients, so a lot of work has been done, some at Mayo Clinic under the leadership of Charles Loprinzi and by others as well, trying to identify non-estrogenic medications that could also treat hot flashes. The most common ones that have been used and found to be effective include antidepressant drugs, also anticonvulsant drugs, but not every patient benefits from those. So that brings us to oxybutynin, which is the medication that we evaluated in this trial. That medication has been found to cause a side effect in patients that take it for other indications. So it's currently FDA approved for overactive bladder, and patients that take it for that indication frequently report decreased sweating. And that observation led to studies that have evaluated the role of this medication in patients that have hyperhidrosis, so sweaty palms or excessive sweating in general. And it has been found to be very effective in that setting. There have been some anecdotal experiences both in the clinic, retrospective, and also one prospective study before that had suggested that oxybutynin could be effective in hot flashes. The one prospective study that that has been published before ours used a higher dose of oxybutynin and incurred in some toxicity that led the investigators to recommend evaluation of lower doses, and that's what we did in this study.
Following suit was Wolfgang Jahni, MD, PhD of Ulm University. When Jahni sat down with us, he highlighted the findings from the interim analysis of the randomized SUCCESS-C study, iterating the importance of lifestyle intervention and its effects on disease-free survival in patients with early-stage breast cancer.
There is increasing evidence that obesity is not only a risk factor for developing cardiovascular diseases and metabolic disorders, but also to develop cancer like breast cancer and colon cancer. We also know that patients who already have suffered breast cancer have a worse prognosis if they are overweight. So the objective of our trial was to find out whether a lifestyle intervention program, which focuses on normalizing the BMI and increasing physical activity, can improve the prognosis of these patients. The SUCCESS-C study was a phase 3 randomized study with two randomizations. First randomization was a chemotherapy objective. Second randomization was assigning patients between an intensified lifestyle intervention program and a control group. Patients in the intensified lifestyle program received a total of 19 telephone interviews with professionally trained coaches, and also accompanied by a work booklet and further information they received by mail. The control group just received basic health information in the health lifestyle magazine. We found out that patients in the intensified lifestyle intervention program lost an average of 1 kilogram over 2 years of time, while patients in the control arm gained 1 kilogram of weight. In the intention to treat analysis, we did not find any difference for disease-free or overall survival between the two treatment arms. However, we noticed that only half of our patients who were assigned to the intensified lifestyle program actually did complete the program. So we did an unplanned exploratory analysis among patients who completed the lifestyle intervention, which we'll call now for now completer. And these patients actually encountered a higher weight loss. So the difference between the two arms now was 3.5 kilograms, which equals about 7 pounds. And we found out that the completer patients actually had a significantly better disease-free survival and also overall survival, both in univariate and multivariate analysis. We are aware that this exploratory analysis will also have some bias. We might call that healthy participant bias, because obviously that might be the more healthy, the younger patients and patients with less disease. But still, we think that this might be some indication that lifestyle intervention can positively influence the prognosis.
Inger Thun, MD, PhD of Oslo University Hospital, provided insight into the emergence of cardio-oncology, speaking to the results of the EBBA2 trial, in which the effect of exercising training during adjuvant breast cancer treatment was examined.
Breast cancer patients have a higher morbidity for cardiovascular disease. And if you are diagnosed with breast cancer in comparison with not having been treated for breast cancer and you are 55 years old, you have a lower survival rate and your life expectancy is nearly 7-8 years. And one of the main reasons who beside breast cancer death is cardiovascular diseases. And in that setting, could it be like that there are important things happen through the treatment period who could affect the cardiovascular capacity function? That was the rationale. The design of our study is a randomized controlled trial, a single country, multi-center, and not blinded for the patient, but for those who assess the measurement. And then they are randomized, all of the patients included are invited and measured and assessed all type of measurement ahead of surgery. They are diagnosed, may have a advanced disease, we don't know, invited, informed consent ahead of surgery, and then after surgery, when we have the whole picture, we randomize them to exercise or control. And then we measure cardiovascular capacity function after 6 months again and 12 months. The intervention group have exercise starting 3 weeks after surgery. They meet for training session twice a week, 60 minutes times 220 minutes. In addition, they are asked to do exercise at home for at least 120 minutes, which means 240 minutes. Then they should do this for 12 months. They take off for holiday and Christmas and Easter and so on. And then they're followed, then the intervention arm are followed throughout 1 year, 12 months, and then to do this activity. The control arm are only doing the standard of care, but no restriction of physical activity.
Closing out our time in San Antonio was Dijon Urick, MD, a medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. Urick presented on the subgroup analysis from the SOLAR-1 trial, in which alpelisib plus fulvestrant was tested in women with advanced breast cancer. Findings demonstrated that the combination consistently improved progression-free survival in patients with PIK3CA-mutated hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative advanced breast cancer.
Approximately 40% of ER-positive patients have this alteration. It is therefore clear that they wanted to develop a selective inhibitor to target this alteration, combine it with estrogen ER targeting, and see the outcome when compared to placebo plus fulvestrant. The study is divided in two main groups, where tissue, either archival or fresh, is used to determine the PIK3CA mutation status. The patients are then divided in two separate cohorts, the PIK3CA mutant cohort and PIK3CA wild type cohort, with randomization in each cohort further stratified by presence of visceral disease or prior CDK4/6 treatment. The total number of patients, 572. In the PIK3CA mutant cohort, we have 341 patients. Should be noted that in other earlier generation PI3 kinase inhibitor trials, these trials are much larger. For example, BEL2 had more than 1,000 patients. In this biomarker-driven trial with a clear hypothesis, we're using a
PI3 kinase alpha specific inhibitor in PIK3CA mutant patients, we have a much smaller number of patients. The primary endpoint was met. There is a clear and clinically significant improvement of progression-free survival going from 5.7 months in placebo arm compared to 11 months in the alpelisib arm. Now, the question is whether all patients benefit equally from this treatment.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 22nd episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you weren't able to attend the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, we will be in Nashville, Tennessee on January 14th for a State of the Science on breast cancer. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal malignancies on January 29th in Pasadena, California. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so that you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.